to welcome all of you who have come online already. We have Dr. Kim Punio from Australia with us today. It's rather early in the morning in Australia, around 4 o'clock, I think. Is that right? 4:30? Something like
5:30. So it's
that.
early, but it's not too early. It's okay.
5:30. Dr. Cunio is the head of the School of Music at the Australian National University. He is a scholar and, as you can see, a composer as well as a performer, with a regular segment on ABC Radio Canberra. Kim is currently finishing a book on sacred music and working on collaborative music projects, one on the sound of space with the British Antarctic Survey, and another one on enforced foeticide, sorry, foeticide, is that right? In India. Kim's going to be speaking on pushing your boundaries and creative collaborative co with collaboration and calmly. For most of us, our comfort zones are where we're very comfortable. The problem is when we are in our comfort zones, we are not able to grow. And so tonight, Kim is going to share with us on how creativity is all about getting past your fears, pushing past your limits and boundaries, and the process that's needed to be able to work with others successfully so that we're creating something greater than ourselves. And finally, how to calm the mind, soothe the soul, and be inspired by the sounds in a noisy world. Kim, I'm going to hand over to you. Just to say, if you would like to ask questions, you'll be able to put your questions to Kim towards the end. If you send them to us, I will be asking Kim the questions on your behalf. Kim, thank you. Over to you.
Aarti, thank you for such a really lovely introduction. And can I say, it's a real joy to be with everyone tonight because it's the end of a working week and this sums it all up. In the midst of, such suffering in the world, all of us really have to play our part, don't we? And, a phrase I like to use that you might have heard before is that even though we take ourselves very seriously on some level, all of us are just playing a part in this most magnificent ultra 3D movie that we've been cast in, which is the great drama of the world. And so, because of that, we have to play our part with as much equanimity as we can. But I would also add, with as much creativity as we can. And that's really because when creativity doesn't work, I think something sort of dies in the soul, And I'm sure we've all had that feeling. And so, I'm going to actually speak today a little bit from a personal perspective, looking at how music has certainly enabled that for me, also about how we can even have large institutions, because the institution I work at is an incredibly creative institution. I might also show you just a little bit of evidence about how this actually works, because we have a wonderful course at the Australian National University called Music, Neuroscience and Creativity, which we give to our PhD students, and it's unbelievable because it's validating, I think, what we know in our hearts, that this is our birthright to be able to make things up and have this sense that we are part of a greater flow in our lives. So I'll look at that a little bit. Then I'll play you a couple of small examples. And as Aarti said, I think it's really important that we actually get to do what the foundation of creativity is, and this really comes from the readings, is the process of stillness. And I'm just going to say that again in order to start, that there is no doubt from the neuroscience literature and from talking to anyone who's deeply creative that you can't be buzzing around like a mosquito and do your best work. Now, I have a cousin who's a very famous composer, and he has a little ritual. And I'm just going to tell you this story because all of us need a little ritual sometimes to be creative. So before he writes a major work, he gets his manuscript. It's a giant sort of A3 because he's generally writing for an orchestra. So then he gets a series of pencils and he sharpens them and he sharpens them again. Then he cleans his rubbers and then he puts them out in a little row. And I remember when I first saw this, I thought, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. Why? This is sort of superstition. And then only later did I realize this is the ritual of creativity that this man has. And for all of us, we need some version of a ritual for creativity. And the good news I'd like to say is that it's the same ritual in many ways as the ritual of innocence, of keeping ourselves pure in a difficult life. Because all of us, in order to do the things we want to do, there's a whole lot of things we probably need to do less of. And, those things are, of course, anger, judgment, unwanted greed. We all know those things that we all get into. We usually really dislike them in others, which means that that's pushing a button in ourselves when we see it. So I thought I'd start off by just getting us to really think about this little no notion. And I think it's a little bit interesting, but maybe I need to get out more. So I'm going to start by sharing my screen in just a second. Please excuse me, I just have to close a couple of things. I've got actually someone's honors thesis to mark on my desktop, so I'm just getting rid of that so you don't have to see that. And I'm going to show you something, first of all, about something called neurons. So I'm just going to share my screen now. And I think you'll find this a really interesting thing. And if not, don't worry, it won't last for very long. So here is my desktop. You can see the chaos of my working life. But at the same time, you can also see this nice little article. And it's really just the abstract I wanted you to think about. Could machines ever take our place in the creation of art and particularly music? The outstanding results of some well-known artificial intelligence, there's things like EMIs and flow machines, might make us believe this is the case. However, despite this evidence, it seems that machines present some intrinsic limits both in creative and non-creative contexts. The arguments of this paper, and I would add for myself, are centered around the belief we are convinced that utopian claims regarding machine intelligence are not plausible and that our attention should be directed towards the computational creativity. But however, there is something else that this paper talks about, which is the body issue, the role of the body in the creation of music. And then later on, I mean, it's a very scientific paper, but I think I have something else later. If I can't find it quickly, here we are. And I just wanted you to think about this little thing. Consciousness is tightly connected with the body, so the corporeal side of musical experience cannot be put aside when talking about what makes the human relationship with music so special. So I wanted us to think about that. And then one more thing, just a little bit later. This is a very interesting thing. And it's not, I don't believe that only musicians can truly resonate, as this thing says. But there's something when we listen to music played on an instrument we can play, or something that we have an experience of, we start to get this very interesting thing. And this is called, I'm going to stop sharing now. And this is called the motor neuron response. In other words, this is what neuroscientists call empathy. Now, if anyone's ever seen, a live performance of just a really beautiful song, it's sort of like you read the words of the song and it seems very, very nice. But when you hear the words of those song and you've got it with the melody and it's incredibly well sung, something quite remarkable does happen. And it's like the empathy gene of us as people sort of explodes. And I think this is what art does so, so very well. And that's certainly why I choose to make my life with it. Another way of us thinking about this is the old analogy of the mines. And we'd have the canary in the coal mine to say when the atmosphere is not breathable. And in a larger sense for our world, we could say that this is essentially what we're all doing. Oh, I'm sorry, I've just seen a note. Can I turn my video up a little bit? I'll just do that now. Just excuse my audio settings if you see that. Might be a sec. Hoping that's a little bit better. So we've got this very interesting notion that music and all those other art forms can also do it to us. So this is again just us thinking about, is it possible for us? Now, a common question that I get from people is, well, if that's true, don't I need to be taught creativity? Don't I need to go to the music school you're at, or an art school, or a drama school, or this or that to be creative? And this is really one of the sad things that I have encountered in my life. And again, the neuroscience tells us something really interesting because there are some fairly objective tests of creativity, actually. And in these objective tests, we find out that close to 98% of five-year-olds are creative. Isn't that astounding? So, you just have to see a child actually being themselves in the playground. And if you looked at one game morphs into another game, the rules are made up as they go along. Someone doesn't like it, the game changes again. Someone else comes in, the game is able to incorporate them. It's a feeling of absolute and complete flexibility. And certainly for myself, that's why sometimes when I really have nothing to do, I put on a kid's cartoon. I'm a huge fan of your Shaun the Sheep, for example, that comes out of the UK, because it's amazing how creative people can be in a 5-minute idiom for kids, knowing that kids are sort of tuned into that space. Now, by the time you get to the teenage years, you're down to below 80%, generally speaking, in the same markers of creativity. And by the time you get to middle age, I've got some bad news. On the same test, it's about 2% of people are functionally creative at the drop of a hat. It's not to say that they cannot be creative, but it's like we have a superpower that has become dormant and buried. And what on earth would that superpower be buried under? And it's buried underneath the analytical self, for want of a better term. The self that has to go in and plan and control. And I'm not saying that we don't need to do those things. We all need to live in the world, of course, you know. So it's a very, very important skill to grow up and do these things. You know, it's hugely important. But at the same time, maybe that incredible innocence of the creative process can be a little bit lost. So this is one of the reasons why we started this new course this year. And we started it in partnership with an organisation called NIDA in Australia, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, which is, you know, Australia, particularly 2 generations ago, was very much modelled on the UK experience. So NIDA is our RADA. And I guess you could say the ANU School of Music is a small version of the Royal College, although we're not quite as prestigious or as well-resourced, sadly. But you get a sense of what we're sort of trying to be able to do is, you know, really foster the arts here. And so NIDA, for about 6 years, have been really studying this in their postgraduate students, the ones who are a bit older, who want to be really functionally creative. And that, for want of a better term, was the writers. They wanted to be able to create immediately at the highest level. So they've been working with a writer called Sue Wolfe, whose life work has been to go in this sort of, you know, space of neuroscience and creativity. And we've been bringing in some of the best neuroscientists in the world. And what they've all said is, what they really want to do is to find ways to be more creative and to find ways to systematize through studying the brain what creativity is. And of course, the brain is an incredible thing. If we think about the brain, it has essentially the inbuilt potential to connect between different parts of it as the entire internet of the world. Let's just think about that. We have the entire internet in our brain that is capable of doing all of these things. And what's more so, we have something that actually is able to control the brain. And this is where I might say something that some of you go, well, of course, and others might go, oh, really? And if you say that, that's absolutely fine. But I personally have a really strong belief that I am more than this body. That as much as I love this body and think this body is the most incredible invention that the universe has ever made, that it just gets up and works. I could get up early today and it could work perfectly. Whereas when I turned my computer on this morning, I had to restart it. You know, the best computer you can buy just is nothing on the human body. But maybe there's something even more than the body. And for want of a better term, and in acknowledgement of all the great religious and spiritual traditions of the world, I would like to say that I'm a soul. You know, that I'm more than this body. And maybe that if I was to visualize it, it could be just by thinking of this space in between the eyes. And I've got something that is the seat of the soul in this body. And for want of a better term, it's a super consciousness that maybe someone like Yogananda defined. It's the idea that I have a part of me that is capable of connecting with what is highest in the universe. And maybe that's not true, maybe that is true, but it certainly helps creativity. This is the funny thing. Because this consciousness that I am more than my desires, because the body is such a vehicle of desires, and those desires are in many cases needed. We have to eat, we have to drink, we have to breathe, so we have to do all of these things. But then the way the brain can react with the body is through slavish work with the senses. And I'm sure we've all experienced this, that, you know, sometimes we know we shouldn't have that second helping or even that third helping for dinner. we know we shouldn't actually have that thought of jealousy or whatever it is that happens, and yet we can't quite stop ourselves. And that's often the relationship between mind and body without a really great circuit breaker. And what is that circuit breaker? Well, one is creative practice. I would say, honestly, having been around artists most of my life, that if you don't meditate and you want to do something else, having a creative practice, whether it's drawing or writing or journaling or practicing an instrument, is truly the most profound thing of all. But on a factor of 10 or 100, the combination of doing this and a practice of meditation seems to me to be the golden egg. And so I wanted to just say that to all of us. If there's one thing we can take on from my little talk today, is that they're not different processes. When we meditate, we're not locking ourselves away from the world and having this sense that, I need to just be there in complete silence. And if I have a thought, it's a really bad thing. The creative bent on meditation is that if a thought comes, that's okay. That's sort of the higher self giving flight to the imagination. And I'm sure many of us have had the occasion where, whether it was on a bus or a plane, well, before COVID, because now we're just sort of a bit paranoid if we're on public transport. But in the old days, when we were doing something where we could allow the mind to wander, often something incredible could happen. And I'm sure many of us have had this experience. Einstein wrote about this, that most of his great breakthroughs came from some process of stillness or just breaking the thread that enabled something new to come along. So all of us can have access to this through this combination, and that's why we will finish today with some meditation. Now, if it's okay with everyone, I'm going to take a short break and show you some of the fruits of my non-labors. So I just want to actually share my screen again. And what I want to do is show you just a bit of a piece that I have quite a bit of love for. So I'll put it on and then I'll see you on the other side. I won't show all of it because we have limited time. But I wanted to give you the thought that this really is possible for all of us, and that maybe I truly believe what I'm talking about. So I just do my share screen again. Think you can see it now, which is really great. So I'll just have to bring up my iTunes. Ooh, hasn't come up. Excuse me, I'll just have to see me find it. It's just my computer's actually very strange today. Things aren't really working on it, so you just have to see me doing my little workarounds. Like even my search button isn't working, so I'm going to stop share while I've got a backup one, so I'll play you the backup one. Have a look at this one. Actually, one second, I'm going to stop the share and reshare just to make sure everything's okay. Thank you. So, folks, that was a little bit of a project that I've worked on. It actually came out earlier this year called Aurora Musicalis. And we've all heard of Aurora Borealis, of course, haven't we? This incredible lights that come, both in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And the Aurora Musicalis was a term I gave to the sounds that you heard. And they're really beautiful. And they're actually made by the British Antarctic Survey, who have essentially an electromagnetic receiver in the Halley Station in Antarctica. And it enables us to hear a number of things. There's a whole series of sounds in there that I could give a whole talk on, but they're basically the sounds of two things. One is the things like lightning strikes coming and being reflected, then the sounds of the solar flares and the solar wind coming in, and also the Earth's magnetosphere. How would I reduce that? I'd reduce that into the idea of this is the sound of our living planet as it exists in space and time. So a bit like we are these sort of, living beings in the world, so is our planet, and so are all the planets. And there's a wonderful project of actually looking at the sounds of space. Often it needs a huge amount of conversion because, what we have in our natural hearing range is very limited. So sometimes things have to be sped up or brought up, literally six, seven octaves. But with the wonders of technology, that can be done. And these had to be converted into sound, but they were very easily done. It wasn't so hard. And I wanted you to experience a bit of that because obviously it's a little bit soothing, and that's part of what today's talk is, this notion that we can also make art or be creative without being a tortured artist. And I really wanted to think about that briefly together, because maybe all of us suffer. Those of us who've ever done a course in Buddhism or hung out with Buddhists would know that there's this thing called, it's the great laws of Buddhism, the noble truths. And the first noble truth of Buddhism, which we all know in our hearts, is in this world that has so much suffering, it is inevitable in some manner that we will suffer. And that's such a profound thought, isn't it? But those noble truths go on to say that there are methods to relieve that suffering, and not only should we relieve them in ourselves, we should actually attempt to relieve them in others. And certainly for myself, that was a profound teaching. I studied Tibetan Buddhism for years before I actually met the Brahma Kumaris, and it was a really wonderful sort of combination in my life. And then for myself, being a meditator with the Brahma Kumaris for a bit over 25 years, I've really found something quite profound. And it's this idea that I can potentially work to accept people as they are. And if I can do that, boy, can I start to rest and do the other things I want to. And it's partly this notion that maybe it's a naive belief that on some level, the way this world is turning, with all its suffering, with all its pain, and all the things that we see that are an absolute injustices, in some level, that is the drama that the soul comes into. And it's not to say that we shouldn't do everything we can to relieve the pain and suffering of others. I'd never say that for an instant. But maybe it's the beginnings of a way of detaching us from the storms of the mind, to say that on some deepest, most profound level, if I have this soul beyond this body, I have something that maybe isn't suffering quite as much as my body or my mind is suffering. And from that, I can find a place of stillness and acceptance. Because as we know, it's very easy to love the people who believe what we believe, who look like we look, who do all the nice things. The only test is when we meet the people who listen to the music we don't like, who cut in for us at the line, who steal things, who engage in acts of violence. They're a little bit harder to love in my experience. And the only way that we can sort of find a way to cope with all the people who are doing the wrong thing is to find some fundamental way to have good regard for them. And I've certainly found that in my time of meditating with various friends from the Brahma Kumaris, but I must say meditating with everyone, because for example, in my workplace, we do quite a lot of meditation. Quite a lot of our staff feel it's a very good way to make music well and to teach music well. So I would say that meditation, being a completely free and open pursuit and a completely non-denominational pursuit, is the greatest gift we can give ourselves, because it's like transforming us from the inside out. That it's like one of those sun lamps, but the suntan comes from the inside of the body, and then over time the glow comes into the face of greater joy. And I hope that doesn't sound too plitty, but I really do believe it. And certainly for myself, you know, I have a fairly full-on job, like probably all of you do. I mean, just to be honest, I usually do about a 60-hour week, because at the ANU School of Music, we have, you know, 300 students, 30 PhD students, you know, 70 staff. You know, it's a big place, and there's a lot going on. And right now, like the whole world, you know, the university system in Australia and much of the world is in crisis, because, you know, in Australia, we rely on international students to actually keep the university system functioning and paying for itself, and none of them are here yet. So, you know, I could be really, really worried about my working life every night and not sleep, or I could choose to say, is there a creative and a spiritual practice that could enable me to move beyond it? And despite the times where I don't completely succeed, I would like to choose the latter, to say that there are some things I cannot control in my life, and I'm not going to try and control everything I meet in this life, so that the things I want to really put my essence into, I have some sense of energy for. I think we have either a question or a statement from Leslie. Would you like to say something or ask a question, Leslie? Otherwise, we can do that at the end. So maybe we'll do that at the end. I think we'll have time for these things. So I wanted to then talk briefly about, if we are to get creative, what does this process of being creative look like? And then we're going to do a little test of that just at the very end. So we've talked about meditation. So I thought we're going to do a proper meditation at the end, but I'd talk you through intellectually what we do with creative practitioners here at the ANU and also in my own teaching life. And the first thing is to ask people to sit very carefully, like they would for standard meditation, and to start to get into the feeling of not being bound by the thoughts they are doing. And it's very important, even if we might have a particular mantra or a particular thought, such as I am a soul, in our meditation practice, in terms of a creativity meditation, to really just allow the brain and the mind to float on top of what the self is. And so just observing without controlling seems to be the clue when we study the brains of creative people. So we do that for a little bit of time, maybe 5-10 minutes. And then when we feel we've embraced the silence or the space is a very nice thought, you know, this sense of, you know, we're talking with the inner space center. And I think that's the perfect definition. There is inner space available to us. Once we feel we have that, and that usually comes to a sensation often with the body, then we go straight into creativity and we do not stop. The main thing that gets in the way of really good creative practice is the thinking brain, which actually says, actually, Kim, I don't like that combination of notes. That's not even a real chord. What are you writing that melody for? Doesn't that sound a bit too like Bach? You know, really, surely your friend wrote something like that last year. Now, we all know that chitter chatter, don't we? It's a big part in all of our lives. It's the compare ourselves to others chitter chatter that is the bane of the creator when they are creating. Now, I've got a friend who's a novelist who said when she's in the creative zone, the characters are talking to her and she's transcribing. Now, that might be the myth of the great composer is that the music is being played to them and they're simply writing it down. Now, functionally, that may not be possible all the time, but we can build like, it's almost like a muscular skill in making things without stopping. Now, the simplest way to do this, if you're thinking, well, I don't have a so-called creative practice that I can apply this to immediately, is through the process of automatic writing, which was invented by the Dadaists, you know, essentially about 100 years ago, because they were dealing with the trauma of what was called shell shock then, that we would now call PTSD. A bunch of young men who were just completely shattered by watching, you know, violence for their whole sort of formative life. And they had to find a way to move beyond it because they didn't have, you know, I guess you could say the depths of modern psychology we have today or things like cognitive behavioral therapy. But they had the therapy of creative practice. And this idea that people would get together and write their thoughts without punctuation, without stopping for periods of time. And then they would look at it and it would be the most incredible jibber jabber of the mind. But then they would do the next stage, which is the really exciting stage. They would look at this stuff and they would find sacred threads that are in the writing. And can I tell you that I see this time and time again with my students and with myself? I'm still, of course, just a student myself. When we get to see the sacred thread of what has been created freely, we can then construct a narrative using that intellectual mind that is just waiting, that is so powerful, that is so dominant. And then it can really serve our higher creative purpose. There was a term in some of the literature called the themata, Themata, themata. This idea that there is a current that goes on. Now, interestingly, some of the more recent research by people such as Leanne Gabora in Canada have actually found that the creative practice of people across disciplines can be seen by people who do not know them. Isn't that incredible? So it's like that if we get into an authentically supercharged creative space, I might be a writer, but when I paint, it's like some sense of the same creative being can actually be perceived by the subtle mind of other people. Isn't that an incredible thought? I have done tests with my students, for example, because a number of really the greatest composers were very fine painters. One example is actually Arnold Schönberg, who's famous for writing sort of, later in his life, a thing called pantonality, atonality, really difficult sort of Western art music stuff. And his paintings are absolutely beautiful. And so we get this idea that creativity is something that can be shared and can be explored within our discipline, across our disciplines, and beyond our disciplines through the process. Because the final point, if we can look for this themata and we can trust this process of creativity, we can apply this creativity if we are a manager, if we are working in accounts, if we are studying for an MBA, if we are caring for someone in a nursing home, if we are caring for a young child. And this is where it gets quite exciting. This notion of creativity over time does not become something that we have to go into our Virginia Woolf room of one's own, which is a beautiful concept. I mean, I always found it fascinating. But what about if every room could be the room of one's own, that we were able to embed a creative way of being with the world with every single thing we do? And now, of course, that's probably not possible all the time. But if we remember that the five-year-old is able to do this in random tests about 98% of the time, surely we can get our quota of creativity up higher. And why do I believe this stuff? The reason why I believe this stuff is that we're testing it. And so, for example, a paper was just released by NIDO, our drama school, looking at their research before my university got involved. And they were finding in most students between a 30 and a 40% version of greater creativity. And this is people who already have a functional creative practice. Now, the people in that study were the Masters of Fine Arts writing people, which are basically the best young writers in Australia coming to the National School to do this course. And they'll be writing for stage and theatre. So these are pretty good people already. They have a practice. And yet they're looking at, over the course of 1 year, a 30% increase in their creative output. Now, that's pretty amazing. So even though I haven't studied it in my work at the ANU, I can just tell you that I'm applying it, particularly with some of my PhD students. And you might say, why do it with them? They're quite advanced. Well, what's interesting is when you do a PhD, you have to really use your intellect. Now, anyone who remembers their university days, they know that, there's this whole notion of attribution of ideas. And if you don't attribute your ideas, it's plagiarism, isn't it? But yet when we're creative, then lines can be very nebulous because something can come out of the ether to us. And only later do we realize, oh, that's an idea that someone else had 100 years ago. So going through this process as a creative person, particularly at the master's or PhD level, can be really, really hard because suddenly this thing that you might have done quite naturally, you're second guessing. And so I've been working with my students to make sure we have this pure creative space, this process we describe, going from complete stillness to complete, almost frenetic creativity with no censorship, and only then looking at the process of analysis. And I can tell you that the students I'm using this on, that their output is becoming very, very interesting. They're doing more, but they're also finding new creative sounds. Now, one of the terms we have in music is what's called finding your voice. that, and I know writers use the term as well, it's like over time we find what it is we need to say to the world. You know, and we all know that we have things to say to the world, but sometimes we open that door and we find that thing. And it's no surprise that when you listen to the music of Mozart, you can hear that it's the music of Mozart. Or if you hear the music of Tyagarajara, Indian Carnatic classical music, if you're of a South Indian body, you can hear that music immediately, because these people have their sound world. You know, they have this strong creative sense, and it's been found. They have their voice. And it's my intention, certainly as an educator and also as a creative artist, to try and find that in myself and really help other people to do that in their own lives. Because I think if we get back to the holistic sort of zooming out, this is where some very deep and profound healing can come. And it's certainly not to say that I have any knowledge or training in psychoanalysis or anything like that. But I think we all know some version of this myth that when we have things we need to process, that those things will be processed in some way. Now, often when things need to be processed, for all of us, particularly stressed, we get stressed, don't we? We have a stressful event, and it plays out in our mind and again in our mind. And if we're not careful, it goes into our body. And then we can have, maybe some small bodily unwellness event, or maybe even a larger one. And that can be really, really bad. And again, I don't want to say that this is to say that we are just automatons who are just getting sick because of our karma. I'm saying that life is just way too subtle for us to know. Because I think we all know people who are the most remarkable people, and we go, why on earth does this happen to them? So I never want to be reductionist and say that we can understand this world. It is too great a mystery for all of us. But we can know that there are a number of methods to process the deep and profound experiences we have, both the positive and the negative, because we all do live in some version of duality. And one is through meditation, this idea that allowing things to settle through a process of regular stillness seems to be the most profound thing I've ever had the chance to do in my life. And its twin for me is the act of creative inspiration, the idea that if something is bothering me, I can make a piece of art to release that from my mind. I want to say that again. So when something really bothers me, I can make a piece of art, and I hope in the essence of my soul that I can release any suffering or attachment I have through the act of making that art. It's very different from the idea of tortured artist has to create, because if they don't stop, that the world will get them. It's a positive version of that, isn't it? Because it's a way to say that maybe there's a way that through art, I can make sure I'm not tortured at all. Now, some people might say, well, does that mean your music's going to have nothing in it? And I couldn't disagree more. I think the human capacity to make great art is just an instant away. There's nothing in any literature that says, in an objective sense, that we have to be suffering to be great creators or great artists. It just happens that a lot of them happened to be, So we can be very, very together in our lives and have very, very good creative expressions. So I'm going to finish my formal talk in a little while with another piece of music. But I wanted to give you one mock question, because this one comes to me quite a lot when I'm talking to my students. And the question is something like, well, if I examine this process of creativity, do I lose it before I get it back? It's a really interesting question, isn't it? Because anything that is unconscious, it's a very strange sensation when we start to examine it. And I want to give you a little example. If we could, here's my hand. I just have to get it in the camera. I'm just checking my pulse as I'm talking. And I can hear my human heartbeat a second away. Now, my pulse might change slightly if I'm in a hospital having my blood pressure checked, right? But if I just get used to examining my pulse 10, 50, 100 times a day, I'll become quite just, it'll become just a very matter-of-fact part of my life. And my pulse really is not going to change very much through the act of me observing it with my body and my mind, because I'm, of course, when I'm listening to my pulse, I have a touch sensation. I then have it transfers almost into the imaginative ear, so I can actually hear the pulse in my head, which is amazing. That's just one of the things the brain can do. And then we also start to analyze the fluctuations in it. So I could tell you, just because it's my discipline, within about 2 or 3 beats per minute, what my pulse is at any time. And that's really impressive on one level, and it's really meaningless on another. So what I have to be able to say to myself is, do I really need to know how many beats per minute my pulse is if I'm just observing it? And this is the process of examining our creativity, that we actually decide how much of the intrinsic workings we can leave to not so much the automatic self, but to the superconscious self, and how much we need to get in there and work with. And the golden rule I've found for great artists is that if something is working really well, there's no need to mess with it. So if we can find methods that do work for us, but the nice thing about being experimenters, which I really encourage everyone to be, is we might find another 2 or 3 methods than the one we're already doing for something. So that's a bit exciting. But the next part is, if something doesn't work, then we start to use our incredible intellects to be our get out of jail free card, and to look at really sophisticated ways to make things. So I think that's just something we could really start to think about. I'm hoping from my little talk that all of us, no matter what we do, no matter what our profession, no matter what our background, it has nothing to do with whether we were in a choir or not in a choir, or we had music lessons or not, that all of us have a birthright of natural creativity in this life. I think that's a really nice thought. But in saying that, I want to acknowledge that, particularly with music, because I hear these stories all the time, that you might have been in that choir at age 8 and you came in a bit late or sang a bit flat, and some quite silly music teacher might have said to you, "You don't sing anymore. You're out of tune." And that can be really hurtful for the young musician. So I wanted to finish with one thought, that for all of us, can we also try not to criticize ourselves as creative beings when we're creating? Because this seems to be the thing that really shuts it down more so than anything. So if we just remember ourselves as that, either that actual person who is criticized a little bit, we can all remember that moment where someone said something about us. Now, for music, it's a really big thing because, I work mainly with classical musicians. They spend their whole lives in practice rooms, right? They were often the best musician in their class in primary school. They were the standout. They were the best in their school. Then they go to the high school. They're generally the best or the second best in their high school. Then they get to university. Everyone in that university was the best in their high school. Now, that's really confronting, isn't it? Then they finish university. They go for that job in the orchestra. Everyone who's going for that job in the orchestra was the best in their university. And in the UK, you've probably got about 15 or 16 great music departments. And then there might be one job coming up every 3 years. We can see that the structures of professional music can be at complete loggerheads with what I've talked about today. So we really need to find a process of resilience to be able to stay creative. And it's resilience and innocence to say that I will have a personal relationship, a loving relationship with the artistic practice or the creative practice that I will work with. I will foster it just as I would any relationship. I will treat it with the utmost respect, so I will not criticize it. I think we all know the term the muse, that if we have a muse inside us, we must sustain her and be kind and gracious unto her. So this is what I wanted to say to us. The last thing, why would we ever criticize our own creative practice? And if we're not going to do that, maybe we should be a little bit careful about criticizing the creative practice of others. And from there, maybe we should be a little bit careful about criticizing others per se. So that's my feeling, Kim's half-hour guide to being a creative being in this troubled world, because it is a troubled world. But I feel so strongly that this is possible for all of us. I'm certainly no more lucky than all of you. I've made an effort to really work on my music through my life. I can tell you that I've met people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who've taken up music and had astonishing results. So there's another myth, particularly with music, that you needed to start at 3 to be good. Now, the reason why kids learn music well as kids is the same reason they learn anything well, because the mind is open. Sure, it's a little bit more flexible, but we have examined the brains now, and we know that all brains retain neuroplasticity until the day they die. Isn't that an incredible thing? The brain is actually capable of change and rewriting its neural pathways at any moment. So I'm going to share my screen again in a sec, play you something else, and I'm going to look if I can find the piece I wanted to play you because it's something of real beautiful, of beauty, and I wanted to show you something that I thought might be quite a nice thing to see. So I'm just going to see if I can get that up for you, but if I can't, I'll find you something else as well. I always have something else ready to go. Give me a sense. I'm getting close. Oh, I'm still having that computer problem. So I will go into iTunes and I'm going to play you something again from my Sounds of Space project because that's the one I'm really working on at the moment. And I'd like to play you a setting of the first gravitational wave. Now, do you all know the story of this, that Einstein predicted this warping in the fabric of space-time essentially just about 100, 102 years ago? And, no one could prove it until essentially a few years ago, where the Geiger interferometer actually picked up an acoustic sound. I just want to make that clear. An acoustic sound was found, which was this sound of a gravitational wave. And it was nicknamed the chirp because it goes, makes this really incredible sound. And that's the sound of, well, it can change from gravity. The most common is the sound of two black holes colliding. Let's just imagine that. It's on a scale that we can't even think of. So I thought it might be nice to play something quite fun because in setting this, I just went through the exact process that I've told all of you about. And so I want you to see this guy believes in what he's doing. And he's able, hopefully, to realize it. So I'm going to share the screen one more time. I'll play this piece and then we'll have time to chat and questions. And I can't wait to meet everyone, because it's just a complete joy in my life to meet people. So I'm sharing the screen now, sharing the sound, and you'll just see my slightly boring iTunes, but you'll hear the last piece, the first gravitational wave. And you'll hear it acoustically before you hear it starting to go into different things. So, folks, I wanted to say such a thank you to everyone. It's been just, you know, an absolute delight for me to be with everyone. What could I just say to finish off with? I really wanted everyone just to have that chance of the mind wandering over that piece. And I hope you are able to do that. So what I've got some really nice questions coming in. So I'm happy to respond to those, but I'm going to just ask us to formalize this practice for a couple of minutes now before we do that, if that's okay. So I'm going to ask us to sit with a straight body and a straight back. You can soften the gaze if you wish. I'm going to take my glasses off. Breathing a little bit slower. Thanking ourselves for being ourselves, this wonderful body that sustains us. And because we rarely do it, I want all of us to thank these wonderful brains we have. Truly the most remarkable evolved thing in this universe in some ways. A whole universe inside all of us. Thank this mind. And from our highest self, we're going to ask that mind, that beautiful mind, that too fast mind sometimes, please look after me. Please rest. Please help me to be more creative in my life. And these good wishes for ourselves, we quickly try and focus to be like super beings. And we turn on our superpower and we imagine that we can send a beam of light up into the cosmos that merges with the source of all creativity and goodness, whatever that is to any of us. Union. And taking a deep breath and coming back to this body, I'll just say a few words to finish off my formal talk. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy, and may all beings be free from suffering and have peace.
Wow. Thank you very, very much, Kim.